Picasso had a great quote that I liked very much, which was, if you get art critics together, they will talk about composition and form and structure of art all day long. And if you get a bunch of artists together, they'll talk about the cheapest place to buy turpentine. So today is our day to talk about where to buy turpentine. You know, we could sit all day talking about our various campaigns and our stories and all of the things that kind of, you know, mean a lot to us when we're talking about storytelling. But I also have very much been into the little tips and tricks, you know, the real minor things that we can do to speed up our game or make our game easier to play, or, you know, try to get to the meat, you know, without having to spend too much time messing around with it. Fourth edition is a great system. I love fourth edition. I'm warning you, I'm a big fourth edition fanboy. But it is a complicated system, too. It has a lot of moving parts. And, you know, when you're running fourth edition, it can be pretty tricky to deal with all of these moving parts. So I think, you know, I think anybody that's DM'd 4E for any given amount of time has come up with their own tricks. And, you know, through the glory that is the internet, we're able to share a lot of these tricks. But I thought it would be fun to kind of sit down and go over them as well. So we're going to talk about we're going to kind of break this up into two sessions, or two main topics, one on game preparation and one on table tricks. So, and you know, we can kind of jump around. There's only seven of us here, so there's no reason we can't jump around all we want and talk about what's going on.
Do you want to
copious notes. Yeah, so we'll introduce who we are, or why we're even here.
Which I forgot to do in my last episode.
Yeah, so I'm Mike Shea, and I write for the website slyflourish.com, which is a website that I put together about a year ago, strictly focusing on making better dungeon masters. And the reason why is because I wanted to be a better dungeon master, so I wanted to have a place where I could really just pontificate in the open. And I started a Twitter feed called twitter.com/slyflourish that has daily DM tips where I you know, post just a real quick tip on how to make games better. And again, a lot of times to stir up conversation about it so that I can secretly steal from other people's tricks and make my own game better.
And I'm Dave Chalker. I run criticalhits.com, general gaming site. We do a lot of 4th edition news and reviews and editorials and stuff. I have both of these guys on my site write about stuff and other guest writers, and we have now Musings of the Chatty DM, who talks about his experience planning and running now just pretty much 4th edition and other stuff. And I've been playing 4E since it came out, and I played 3rd edition and 2nd edition through the whole time, so I've been playing D&D a long time, usually running stuff.
I'm Matt James. I am a freelance writer and game designer. I write for Wizards of the Coast, Open Design, Kobold Quarterly. I also do some stuff for Critical Hits. I also maintain the website loremaster.org. That's about it.
You are the best of the two.
Oh,
James
I am the
brothers.
Greatest. Thank you for
the
running.
Greater James brother.
I am the greatest.
About it.
Yes, I am the best James brother here at the convention.
Maybe even in the state.
Maybe in the state. My brother is also a freelancer for Wizards of the Coast. His name's Brian R. James. You guys can find us on Twitter and Loremaster.
And between the two of you, we have an unstoppable force.
Yes, we will conquer the world.
Excellent.
So prep, that's what we want to talk about first.
Yeah, so I guess we'll talk a little bit about preparation. There's a couple of tricks that I really like with prep, and then there's I think three tools that I'm going to talk quickly about and then shut up for a couple minutes. There's a great book that I read, that I actually read before I started. I think it was right around the time I was DMing 4th edition, that has nothing to do with dungeon mastering at all, but has to do with any kind of creative art. And it's called The Creative Habit by Twyla Tharp. Has anybody heard of this book?
Yep.
So it's a great book for writers. It's a great book for, I think, anybody that's doing any kind of creative field. Twyla Tharp is a producer of Broadway shows, and she will have her kind of job is such that she'll have a producer come up to her and say, okay, we have a venue booked. We've already sold out on the tickets. They were, you know, hundreds of dollars each. You have three nights. Here's the cast you're going to have to use. And we have no idea what you're doing. And by the way, you have 7 months before it's got to be up and running and walk away. You know, do something wonderful. And she has no idea what it is. You know, she'll be anything from, you know, something like Cats to an homage to Billy Joel. And she has to just draw it out. So this book talks about her process for how she can take something that's so fuzzy and wild and put it into these steps that she can walk through and consistently make a great show every time. And one of the tricks that she talks about in that book is having a box. And when she says a box, she actually means a physical banker's box that you can buy at Staples for like $2. And in that box goes anything that has to do with whatever show that you're working on. So in the case for D&D, you know, if I have a campaign that I'm working on, I have a box for that campaign. And every time I find like a photograph that reminds me of something cool I want to do, or, you know, some note that I took somewhere on a 3x5 note card that I want to use for the campaign, you know, I write it on and I throw it in the box. You know, I have like, my niece gave my wife like this, you know, $2 little gem. You know, it's a little heart-shaped gem. And I don't know, you know, I looked at that and I said, I have no idea what I'm going to do with that, but I can think of like 5 different things that could equate to as a physical prop for my game. So I just grabbed it and threw it in the box. You know, and someday I'm going to be digging through that box and I'm going to go, oh, the gem, and it's going to become a phylactery for a lich, or it's going to become, you know, some soul-stealing thing. And I'm actually going to hand it. Yeah, it's a heart-shaped thing, right? So I'd actually be able to hand it. And hopefully she'll forget that I ever brought that up. So when it shows up, it'll be a surprise. But so having this actual physical box that you can throw things into, and even one, you know, and I throw all my prep stuff in there too, all my game stuff, so that I can just grab it and kind of move it around. Dungeon tiles go in there and everything. But I think that box is really a useful, you know, it's useful both physically, but it's also useful mentally to kind of keep track of everything and throw everything in there. So that's one of my prep tips that I like.
Yeah, that's good. I take a lot of notes. I use a lot of digital tools. Like I use like Google Docs, and now I use Google Wave. I take a lot of notes. I do a lot of collaborative stuff because without getting too much into me telling you about my campaign, because that's always thrilling.
We'll have a house rule here.
Yeah, exactly.
No talking about your game.
But overall, like I run
very little.
I run in one time period, and then my friend's running another campaign on the same game world hundreds of years later, and we collaborate on a lot of stuff. I mean, we do our own adventures, especially because I'm playing in his campaign, and he wants to keep some surprises. But what I do is, you know, I'm throwing my notes into something that he can see, so then he can pick up on, you know, like maybe a location or a character that I'm talking about, and he can use that, you know, as like, this is that thing hundreds of years in the future. You know, he can use it for his own campaign, and he gives me feedback, and I get, you know, there's other people I like to work with on, like if I'm stuck on something, I'll say, please take a look at this document and give me some ideas. But those things, you know, both, like, are just ideas that I'm throwing at it whenever, like, it's just this morning, this is, like, in the shower is where I come up with most of my creative thinking, and I think that's actually the case for a lot of creative people. But anyway, so, like, I was just thinking about something else, and I was like, wait a minute, what if the Deva had a long-lost wife who we forgot about? And it's like, okay, I don't know where that came from, but it's going into my campaign, you know, just, like, these random bits, and just try to write down whatever I can and throw them somewhere so I can come back later. And even if it's not something I can use immediately, you know, it's filed away so that I can combine it.
And you file that into Google Docs, you said? Is that
I use Google Wave a lot. Wave has kind of replaced it just because, you know, I've got multiple people looking at it. But I also like taking notes on my phone a lot and just wherever I can, just to have it down somewhere that I can look back later and then use, especially if I'm stuck or if I want to kind of plot things out ahead of time. That's my big thing overall.
Matt, what do you do?
I think the reoccurring theme here is when you're finding ideas, you take them and you contain them somewhere, whether it's a box or Google Docs. As much as we like to think we have these, you know, huge, gigantic brains that can contain all of it, you just simply can't, and you'll miss the little things like the little heart or something that you might have written down from on Google Docs. In my home office, I have a gigantic whiteboard. And what I do is, aside from writing a big master list of ideas, I can also draw lines between ideas and start scoping out how a storyline will go, how an entire arc will go. And it kind of gives you that 360 bird's eye view, so to speak, of how you want your story to unfold. Of course, you have to account for your players doing something, you know, completely what you didn't plan for, but you still want that foundation to be there. And I do a lot of ad hoc type stories where I have the world presented, and I'll write up a basic description before the campaign even starts. Of say if I have five different villages, I'll do a little blurb on each village. You don't want to spend the time to completely flesh them out unless you have the time to do that. But it allows so that if the players, for whatever reason, the story pulls them in one direction that you might not have accounted for, you still have a little bit about, say, that village and whatnot. And then you always go back. I always go back to the whiteboard when the players do something like that. And then you know, okay, I need to flesh this area out a little bit more. But bottom line, it comes down to preparation. I use, as far as storing things away, that's what I use the whiteboard for. I'll go up and I'll write down something, or I'll write, you know, basically what they're doing, but just in a different media. So,
what do you guys use? How many people here DM games regularly? And what do you guys use when you're prepping your games?
Have you ever heard of Master Plan?
Yes, I've heard it's awesome.
It's getting even more awesome with their latest updates.
That's what I hear.
I haven't used the latest ones, but when I designed a My Realms adventure, it was very useful.
Yeah, I hear it's great.
It's like a combination of the whiteboard concept, because you flowchart different adventures, you can rearrange them, or like encounters.
It's called Master Plan?
Yeah. There's something similar called Y-Writer that...
Master Plan specifically for 4th edition.
It's built. You not only do you whiteboard these genre squares around, you click on them, then it pops up an encounter.
I might have to write that in.
You can make it a skill challenge or regular encounter, or just pop in notes, attach maps.
It's called Master Plan?
Master Plan.
Is it Windows?
Yeah. Oh, that's why I don't run it.
I run Windows.
Oh, well.
Is there an iPhone app?
Yeah,
that was one of the tools that I use, and I just started getting into is Evernote, and I'm using Evernote for everything. And what I like about it is I have a work machine, a home machine, and my iPhone, and it syncs across all three automatically. So if I'm at work and I just, you know, some, you know, God knows I don't just sit, you know, brainstorming all day long at work, but if I did, you know, I could find an idea and just throw it into Evernote, click save, and know that when I go home it'll be there.
Yeah,
and also I
browse your email.
Yeah, use it. Right.
Photos and emails.
And I've actually started, like, writing out flavor text, where just wherever I happen to be, I'll start writing it out flavor text, and I'll save it, and then at the game, I'll just pull out my iPhone and pull up the Evernote thing and read the flavor text aloud. Saves me, you know, a little bit of printing,
but
it's a great program.
Using these tools to prepare, you'll find that your actual play time goes a lot smoother.
Yeah.
You'll find that the more time you spend in prep, I personally spend more time in preparation than I do actually worrying about specifics of that night's session. Because I find if I prepare adequately using any of the methods that were presented today, you'll find that your adventures move quicker, they move more seamlessly, you find yourself less having to fumble through notes. And we all know, we've all played, we know when someone's prepared and when someone's not prepared. And I can't emphasize enough the importance of pre-planning.
You guys raise your hands. As far as running games, is there anything that you guys use when you're prepping that you like?
Microsoft OneNote.
Yeah. OneNote. Yeah, a lot of people use OneNote. Yeah. That's a good one.
Old-fashioned notebook and a pen.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. Same
that's,
concept.
That's actually, right. Yeah.
If I write it, it works in my head. Like, once I write it, I remember it.
Yep.
My other favorite tool, and this is something I use for absolutely everything, is I always have a notebook on me everywhere.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, the universal capture device for any kind of idea that comes along.
Yeah,
I'll use it for
old fashioned technology.
Yeah, and it's easy to use, and
I
can run over it in a car,
know,
and it's okay.
Like what kind of things you're going to think about and need, so I'll just leave a section for this, section for that, and I'll go back and fill it in as it comes to be more.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the? I was trying to think about different things we could talk about today, and Michelle and I were driving back from here yesterday, talking about things, and one of them were some of the questions or some of the main things that we do when we're prepping a game. You know, right before the game, or not necessarily right before, but, you know, I know a lot of us will spend a long time thinking about our campaign and where the whole thing is going to move and where it's going, but then we're like, yeah, but I got a game in 2 hours.
Yeah,
you know, what are the things I got to do to make sure that the game in the next 2 hours that's going to run for 3.5 is going to be good and fun? And so, you know, Michelle and I were bouncing back and forth on the things, and you know, you clued me into a couple yesterday that I immediately said, I got to start adding this in. But for me, some of them were, you know, making sure that I have fun and interesting environments. And these are often things I'll forget. Because it's like, okay, I got to have monsters and I got to have a place for them to fight. That's easy.
Yeah.
But what's not easy is, well, how can I have an environment that is challenging for the players but fun for the players too? Because a lot of times you'll create, you know, I'm an evil DM. But the good news is that my evilness and my incompetence are both equal. So it ends up not being so bad for players. But You know, it's easy to try to come up with environments like, well, you're in a giant room filling with lava while you're fighting a red dragon. Well, you know, great, that's a good challenge, except the players hate it, because who wants to wade through lava? You know, but if you say, like, well, there's little perches, and up on those perches are crystals that give you radiant damage to your arrow strikes. Well, now they have a reason to go someplace that's fun for them. So, you know, trying to find interesting environments that are fun for players more so than just useful for monsters is something. Having important choices overall. I don't know if you guys are playing, I think pretty much everybody on Earth is playing Dragon Age, right? But, you know, if ever there's a game, Dragon Age for PC and Xbox, and I guess it's on PS3 too, has a great structured storyline with lots and lots of choices throughout. And they're meaningful choices that actually matter, but they don't necessarily change how the game's direction is going. And if you're like me and you tend to railroad a game, you know, finding ways to add in choices like that, you know, you know, I said I wasn't going to talk about a campaign, didn't I?
Uh-huh.
Crap, I'm already breaking the rule. So I'll be very, very fast. One of the fun choices was they had to stop this evil well, and the only way to do it was for it to devour a soul. So, what's going to happen? And, you know, one player knew about this before and had decided that she's going to be the one to jump in this thing. And it was only at the last minute that someone said, wait, I have an intelligent weapon that we really don't like, and threw it in. And that was the soul that was devoured, which is going to turn into something that happens. But I had no idea what they were going to choose.
Yeah.
They were going to, like, shove someone else in or, you know, try to find. And luckily they were fighting nothing but undead, so they couldn't throw an enemy.
I think that also that hits on a point about leaving chance for creativity. Mm-hmm. Like, you can present with these open-ended choices that you don't necessarily know what the end result is. You just sort of have a general idea of what some options they could present. Like, I'm sure
presuppose the answer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm sure you thought, like, well, they could end up sacrificing a PC, and that could be one outcome, but also they have this chance to open it up to something bigger. I'll talk about someone else's campaign. There was, like, this big ritual that needed to happen, and there was this theme about the number 19, and so it's like, well, what do you want to contribute to this ritual? And, you know, there's some easy ones, like they could have donated, you know, like gold in, you know, pockets of 19 or whatever. Someone was like, well, I'm going to cut off my pinky because then I will have 9 extremities or 9 19 fingers and toes. And he was like, wow, that, you know, and they came up with all these other ideas, you know, that around it that were really interesting.
Right. Matt, do you have any tips for choices and how to make meaningful choices that, you know, still fit well into a game?
Nope, you guys don't.
Railroad them always.
You guys actually do a lot of...
I mean, I'll tell you, the two games that I've played in the last, and maybe three if I include Fallout 3, but for video game and PC games, you know, Mass Effect 2, Dragon Age, and Fallout 3 are all games that have a pretty rigid structure to them, but show how choices and character choices can matter more so than... You know, left door and right door choices suck. You know, I mean, you're not giving your players choices if you say, you have 3 hallways you can go down. You know, oh, great, why do I care which one of the 3?
I also keep index cards off to the side, different multicolor ones, however you want to do it, doesn't much matter. And if players make certain choices on the storyline, and maybe they even surprise you because there's no way you can account for everything, I'll write down the NPC's name. And I'll put +1 modifier to all diplomacy or social skill checks dealing with this player, with this character, because of how you interacted with them, and you push it off to the players, and they kind of store that away, and you never know when that's going to come back up, especially in a dynamic world, or if they piss off someone, you know, maybe they get a penalty to checks and stuff like that. But then you don't have to keep track of everything in your campaign notes, because you're handing out these index cards that, when it comes into play, that's when it's presented. So, going with the dynamic. But you're not railroading the story. The story must go on. You're presenting a story, but at the same time, you're allowing for a lot of side things to happen.
Wide rails.
That can influence how things go. And I'll tell you what, especially in a long-term campaign, it is really cool when they bust out a card that you awarded them 5 months prior, and you're like, what? Where did I... Oh, that's right, you did this, and then it's like, oh, and then everyone gets, you know, it's really fun.
I went to a seminar by Monty Cook who was talking about just dungeon design, and so it's not even just overall campaign flow. You can also think about a dungeon, you know, sort of as a flow chart by itself, and you're, you know, those kinds of choices are classic, like, do you go down the left quarter or the right quarter, and, you know, like, some of the time it's just like you're... Like, my party has a rule just, like, always go left, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, they don't worry about it. Yeah.
The rule of left.
He's saying that should still be an interesting choice. Like, even if you just say, there's a weird smell coming down this way, and there's, like,
waves
clawing noises.
Yeah.
Yeah, waves of heat from one way and, you know, screaming from the other way, you know.
Right.
Like, do we head towards the screaming where somebody's dying to rescue somebody, or do we run away from the screaming because it's nasty and killing somebody? You know, you're still presenting these sort of mini choices, you know, and there's not a right answer.
Yeah.
It's just you're making every choice meaningful.
Yeah, the damned if you do, damned if you don't choices are always fun, too. You have to kind of sprinkle them in lightly because it'll
piss them off. Everything they do is wrong.
But it's like, you know, we have this, you know, there's this demon you've been hunting forever, but it turns out he has a critical piece of information that he won't tell you unless you let him free. You know, and you're like, you know, and half the players like, kill him anyway, I don't care.
I was in a Shadowrun campaign where, you know, we were sent on missions, like everyone, and at the end of every adventure, like, the guy who gave us the mission would betray us. And so it got to the point where, you know, like, we would always have the choice to, like, go on the mission or not, but that was, like, the adventure. And so we could either, like, not play or, like, have this guy inevitably betray us, like, in every adventure, you know. That's not a good choice.
Yeah.
Right. The other one that I picked up from you yesterday was thinking about, you know, at least each main battle and saying to yourself, what are the criteria for success in this battle other than wiping it out?
Yeah, other than just putting objectives beyond just kill them all, you know. Especially, that's one of my big tips for actually playing, is if, like, you're bothered about combat length or people aren't enjoying it or whatever, you can have these sort of outs that, you know, they can focus on specific goals that aren't just doing the most damage, you know, or whatever. Have them make interesting choices during combat, too, you know, to be go after this bad guy because he has the thing he wants, or, like, his burly bodyguards that will probably pound us into a pulp if we don't.
Well, my DM yesterday gave us a choice when we were fighting a brown dragon, and we were able to intimidate it into backing down, which is, you know, it involves a social skill, obviously, and it was a team effort, and the way he handled it was great, but it just shows you that there are ways that, you know, he was able to satisfy both sides. The people, you know, my particular character was all about just killing stuff.
Yeah.
But we, at the same time, it was a decision because, yeah, we could kill it, but we would prolong things because it would have probably pushed into another encounter, you know, without spoiling what's going on. But
yeah, the Draconomicon 2, I think, talks about duels, you know, dueling dragons, which is something I tried in a campaign and really liked, where, you know, the dragon has to bloody three of the players before they bloody it, and it's a much faster battle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just as exciting. And, you know, when it bloodies one guy in the first round, it's like, oh, that's one down, you know.
Right.
It gets very exciting very quickly and allows for a lot of storytelling options because you may have defeated the dragon, but now, and in the case of our campaign, and I'm filing my rule again, it becomes an ally of the party, you know, and now they have this draconic ally that they go back to because they, and it is subservient to them because they beat it in combat.
Yeah, I also find in a lot of games there's a lot of push and pull between the people who want to kill everything for the XP and the people who want to negotiate with everything, and then people in between, depending on the circumstance.
Yeah, you sort of have to XP anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Well, but still,
they want to see the high number damage.
Yeah, they want to.
Wait, you wouldn't do it all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, so being able to sprinkle in both, you know, like, no, he's a demon and he's really going to kill you. You're not going to intimidate him.
Right,
you know,
right. Like
that's not going to happen. But at the same time, this dragon can be talked out of it. You know, he's maybe a little unhinged, but you can talk him down, and then you won't have to fight. You know,
I think the last prep thing that I thought about that I liked is just general brevity in things. I think we all have really big story ideas that go on in our heads, and we all have kinds of lots of things. You know, this is our medium, right? This is how we want to express ourselves and everything else. And the problem is that the end result can be these really very complicated, very drawn-out things where we've spent, you know, 40 or 50 hours of the week thinking about it when our players have spent about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And I like to think of it that, you know, they don't...
Those 15 minutes are where we're going to play and what.
Yeah, right. Like, I don't even have my character sheet, you know, and you spend all this time. So I tend to think of, like, we're not doing War or Peace, we've Gone with the Wind. You know, right, they want Roadhouse, Walker, Texas Ranger, you know. They want, like, look, every Walker, Texas Ranger, there's two fist fights with the local, you know, the local yokels, and where are our two fist fights, you know? I expect a certain structure to our game, and I want that structure. I think the designers for the game Portal had something really interesting where they said, they had done this whole big story for the game, and then when people were playtesting, they would stop it and say, okay, what's going on in the story? And the players would be like, I don't know. And they said, okay, our story is too complicated. And they would continue to draw the story back until they knew that when they could get normal people to sit down and play through the story, that they could recite it back to them. And I've done that periodically throughout my campaign. I'll stop and say, okay, you know, what are your goals? They're like, kill Orcus. You're like, okay, good. You know, that's enough. So
another advantage of that is you can still have some depth to the story after you've trimmed away some of the fat, just not make it essential. Like, you know, you need to know everything that's going on at all time. Right. You know, like the players don't have to know. You know, you can sort of sprinkle in things that if the players figure out, they're like, oh wait, that was that guy, or you know, oh, he must have betrayed him when we left, or you know, that kind of thing.
And you start rewarding those players that are paying attention. And what happens is the people who aren't paying attention want to get rewards too. And when I say rewards, I don't mean like static bonuses or anything, but just whether it's attention, story reward, whatever. They'll start paying attention because they're like, whoa, that sounds cool. I want to get in on that.
Yeah, I think I like the campaign mission statement. You know, if you can, you need an elevator pitch. And yeah. If your campaign is so complicated that you can't say what it is in a sentence, you know, then I mean, on the other hand, I just sat through the 5x5 seminar that you gave, and I'm thinking, well, I don't know. There's, you know, something like that. You're not necessarily going to have one.
I think you'd have an elevator pitch even with that structure.
Yeah. So I think you know that keeping it brief and just remembering that your players have a limited attention span can be something that's hard for us to grasp because we have such big ideas that we want to.
We're like, I spent so much time developing all these personalities. Why don't you care?
And luckily none of my players would ever be caught dead at something like this, or none of the people that I played with. But I sat in a campaign where the guy had this, like, you know, reams of handouts, and just, you know, every 3 days I got an email of 2,000 words. I'm like, oh my god, I just want to stab stuff with my rogue. You know, I want to backstab. That's really all I really want to do, is the pointy end goes into that guy. So then I'm like, who's this, you know, and I think we played for like a year and a half, and I had no idea who we were fighting. They're like, Moharandi or something. So, I hope they don't listen to this. So,
Yeah, well, my number one DM tip for absolutely everything is just know your players and play to your players. Because
it's their game, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they might have, you know, tolerance for, like, you know, 5-page stories every week. You know, like, they might really be into that. You know, my players wouldn't, I wouldn't, but, you know, if that's what your players are looking for, you know, within reason, like, if you're a DM and they're asking for 5-page stories and they're not helping, then...
Gotta write another essay.
But, you know, just... judge their tolerance. Like, if all they want to do is kill stuff, and they really, like, nobody cares about all of the deep story stuff, and, you know, no matter what you're throwing at them, they're not picking up on it, you know, maybe you can just scale that back and just say, okay, I can just, you know, do what makes us both happy here. You know, just do whatever works for your players. Mm-hmm. That's my big thing. Now, that said, always try new things. You know, you can always try to spice things up.
Yeah, you gotta try. Yeah, a lot of that is you might not know which player is really the story player until you send him an email one-on-one and just say, you find a strange note and it says this, and suddenly they get into it. You go, oh, okay, you know, it sparks.
But if it falls flat, you know, then you
let it go.
Try not to let any single player in your party kind of dominate your attention. Sometimes it's hard to do. You might be better friends with someone at the table. It is very visible when someone does do that, so you got to try to find ways to draw in the other players and make sure that all the cool story stuff is not always being handled by this one player.
Right, because you and that other player sync really well.
Yeah.
Or you might be dating or married to them.
So you end up making it a D&D game of one, and there's some supporting people there. Okay. You know what I mean?
You're doing a lot of this, right?
So, but at the same time, you know, like, if it's a guy, like, I'm extremely extroverted, so whenever I play the bard or warlord and stuff, I'm always out there talking and stuff, but... it's easy for me to kind of overshadow other people at the table. So maybe the DM, you know, the NPC that they're interacting with doesn't like the fact that this guy won't shut up. So I'm just not going to deal with him. And try to find ways to, you know, pull in information from your characters. I don't know too many DMs and it's not a slight to these DMs, but who don't know anything about the characters that they're playing with. All they know is they know their race, their class, and their name, and their initiative modifier. You know what I mean? Right. But they really don't know anything about any kind of background or anything. And I'm a 3x5 card freak. So just have the players write down some basic information. You'll be surprised. You know, even the power game.
You stare at him with your gray eyes, you know.
My favorite new question for, you know, I kind of like these real simple questions that you can ask people to kind of draw out from their character. And my new favorite one is, what's that character's secret? You know, what's that one piece of information the character knows about that nobody else knows about? And you can't betray it. You know, but you want something that kind of, and it kind of gets them thinking about, oh, I don't know, what is
it? And then it comes to
secret?
Light, yeah.
Yeah, because it's easy to say, like, well, what's a, you know, what does your character want? Well, I don't know what I want, so how do I know what my character wants?
But it ends up pulling out a lot from that player. You'd be surprised. That one, like, when you did it for the one shot, you know, I had to cut back on mine because I was about to type him up a 2,000-word document. Because
Great archive.
Exactly. And then I was thinking to myself, damn, that one question drew a whole lot of creativity out of me. And I wasn't even...
You still ended up starting off in a bar.
Exactly. Yeah. Which was funny. But we...
Level 27 characters
level 27
starting off
in a bar. But no, I mean, the point being is, I had no inclination. I was like, I'm going to go play a one-shot. I'm making this character. I don't care. I'll come up with my basic stuff, but he asked me this one damn question. And I remember, I was like, that's really thoughtful. And then I was like, well, it wasn't 2,000 words. It was probably about 500 words, which is still way more. And I was just like, dude, I'm not playing this character beyond
three. You're going to play for 3.5 hours.
Play for 3.5 hours.
5 hours for the background story.
I love forcing secrets on players, too, though.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, we hate you.
Yeah.
And we love you.
I mean, there were... I'm going to talk about my campaign again. There was one guy who was like, he was really unsatisfied with his current character, the paladin. We arranged for him to have a noble death and all. He's like, oh, the assassin's coming out. I really want to play an assassin. I was like, and he was like, well, I can, you know, have this relation to the character I had. And I was like, oh, but how would you like to play a guy who has the Eye of Vecna but doesn't want anyone to know? And he was like, oh, awesome, you know, like, because it's probably not something he would have attempted to, you know, anything like that on his own. I was just like, here's actually something that happened to you, and, you know, that ties him into the story, you know, in both directions.
You reminded me, I don't know if it's a product of second edition, I still like randomness sometimes. Like, you remember the old random tables you roll on and stuff? But with home campaigns, reminded me of, so forcing things on a player, so to speak, is 3x5 cards, you write character traits. You know, it could be anything. It could be, you know, you have a dislike for cats. Or you just sit down and you write them out. Don't even think about it. Just write them until you come up with a bunch of them. And before you start your campaign, you have the players draw X amount of cards. And it seems inconsequential, but it'll also help that player role play, because then you're giving them purpose, direction, motivation, so to speak, to how to present their character. And it's funny to see how things turn out.
Yeah, I do. I don't do this every time, but I'll hand out a card that just has like a weird thing that happened to you that day. So one might be you wake up and one of the other characters is staring at you. Another guy stubs his toe really hard and never gets over it the whole day.
You slept terrible last night.
You got a creak in your back.
You got a creak in your back, and you know, you're little irate today.
Right.
And you'll always get a character. It's funny, man. But it's funny because you always get the character who's like, so does this give me a bonus?
Right.
Or
how does that work out?
And they just look at you with this, like, they're like, they're trying to figure out, like, what does this mean? And it's like,
you're minus 10
hours? Like, no, it's role playing.
Right,
just take with it and do what you want. And they're just like, oh, okay.
So I think we've already started segueing over into table tricks. Do you guys have any
tricks?
Yeah, what are your table tricks that you really
like? Little tent idea.
I was going to talk about the tent idea. Has anybody not heard of the 10 idea, the 10 cards, you know, the 10 card initiative system? You know, very, very expensive, very, very high tech. 5x8 cards that are cut into strips that you can hang over. And the nice thing is you put names on both sides. And that way, both you and the players can see initiative at all times. You can kind of pick one of your players and say, you are the initiative, you know, the initiative guy. Here's a hammer. When people are going slow, it's your job to hit them with the hammer. And the problem is, like, a lot of people use, like, a, you know, an paper initiative tracker or some kind of handheld one. But then either they have to see it or
they can't see
it.
Who's
half the time I'm too busy,
right.
You know, so the thing gets lost and they're all
Yep, and then people are constantly,
so the more
you are constantly looking up at the board to kind of figure, because it also plays in the strategy as well and tactics.
And then that can be good or bad. You know, you might leave spaces or just not put the monster one up.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you use for a marker to say what turn currently is?
You know, you can throw anything. Sometimes
just shift them down.
Yeah.
Is what I've seen people do.
I have one where just people write little disparaging remarks on it. So then we just keep, you know, putting it on people, and it's like the
I don't use the 10 cards. I have a like a whiteboard behind me that's got like custom cards for characters.
It's the same kind of thing though, right? Everybody can
see. So that everyone can see it. Yeah, exactly. I tend to stand up a lot when DMing.
So you've got the conditions.
Yeah, so then the other one is I just took the same 5x8 cards and made condition cards for all the major conditions. And you can fit about three of them on one person. But the nice way is I always forget what conditions are currently applied to certain players. And it'll happen often where a guy is dazed and then he's done his three actions and then we're way down the pike and they go, oh, that guy was dazed. Yeah. And, you know, he killed a guy and that guy would have done something else. And it's too far along to, you know, recursively, you know, go back. So I find that when both myself and my players are able to see all of the conditions on everything, generally, then it works a lot better. Plus, it's cheap and it's easy and it's fast, and those are all things I really like about.
I divvy out roles to players, meaning to help things progress along. You can even do it with initiative if you want to assign someone to attract initiative and stuff. But usually, there's like the story keeper, the lore master, so to speak, who will. They like writing anyways, and they want to write down everything the DM is saying, and that's good. I actually welcome that because there's stuff I'll even forget, but the player's writing it down, so I'm like, oh, that's right, yeah. So, yeah, that's a little trick. I've never had an issue finding at least one person that's willing to write things down. What other kind of table tricks do I do?
You do the bottle ring trick?
Yeah, that's why I was going to hand this to you.
These?
Yeah,
this is the
cheap.
You know, you can use Aaliyah tools, which cost $45, and you can steal these from Coke bottles at work.
Yeah.
You know, and I saw them. The thing I like about these.
For you.
If you don't want to buy.
Oh, excellent.
If you don't
I'll take
want,
it.
Yeah, I was about to say hair ties.
Yep.
Yeah, the other one I like is I'm becoming the new big fan of the pipe cleaner. But I will warn you, there's one major problem with pipe cleaners, which is it's both a warning and a good sign that when you have these sitting around and you turn this way and you turn back, the player will be wearing them. So, but it gives you an idea that if they're wearing them, then you might need to pick up the pace on your story.
I've also
a
seen the multicolor mini clothespins, or you know what I'm talking about, the clips, yeah. And you can just assign different colors, and then you just clip it to the mini itself.
Really, they clip on them pretty well.
Oh, absolutely.
Huh.
I saw one just yesterday that was pretty impressive. I have to look into it. The guy had little metal flagpoles.
It's right there.
Yeah.
I've got some of those too.
It's like five people in the room, and two of them are talking.
Yeah, I've got some of those as well. I didn't like them. I wasn't a big fan of the flagpoles.
Little miniature flagpoles that are magnetic, and then there's all the conditions, and they'll just snap right onto it.
I need something like that just to number the monsters.
That's what it's good.
You know, I have a pretty big table. Yeah, I have a pretty big table.
So you got these little.
Oh yeah, I've seen those.
Yeah,
you know, I have a big table, and the person at the end of the table is usually my wife. You know, I'll have the battle right here, and she's way at the other end, and she's just like, shoot the closest orc. I'm like, I don't know which one that is, you know, and there's this back and forth until we figure out which orc we're talking about.
There's only so many of these rings that can fit on a mini before you can't tell what's on where.
Yeah, we had a mini that was falling over from too many marks, but I thought that fit pretty well.
So, action stands, Andrew Barlow makes those, Dark Platypus Studio.
Yeah. Yep, Dark Platypus.
Yep.
Yeah, the thing I like about the rings is you can throw them over a mini and take them off without having to move the mini around. And I think with Aliyah, you have to lift the mini up and put them on.
So what I do is, like, I only use the magnets now for stuff that's under player control. Like, people have their own colors. So if, like, the fighter has his own mark and then the paladin has his mark and whatever. And then for conditions, I started giving out cards that, like, it goes right on their character sheet that they play. So, like, they can't make their, like, if they, it comes to their turn, they look at their, thinking like, oh, I'm slowed, you know, like, it's right there.
There's these printable, like, tent cards you can make that have the actual description of the condition.
That's what I'm doing.
So there's no, what is
so, like,
slow
what
again?
Does that do?
Yeah, you know, it's sitting right there. I actually made those, and then that day I made these. And I said, you know, these are just a little easier. And the charts in it.
But people like, I mean, you don't need as many bits, I think, as we have or everyone does. But I'm really into, especially somebody like you can't draw worth a damn. Like, I never draw my own maps. You know, I always use like tiles and pre-done maps and stuff. I like having a lot of bits, and I like having, you know, like, especially it uses all Dwarven Forge, you know. You know, I like having a lot of those pieces of stuff because it's just more interesting to me.
I was telling Michelle, I'm a complete snob now when it comes to maps because, you know, I go out of my way to make sure I got minis that are at least close to the minis that the guys were fighting. And, you know, a lot of times I'll have a game where they're like, oh, okay, this, you know, harpy right here, that's actually a unicorn. And you're like, man, I've lost it. You know, what is it? You know. So, but that's, I think that's me. That's the problem I have. The pipe cleaner is the other thing that these are really great for is area effects. You know, you can bend them to the exact portion of an area effect, and they're light enough that you can literally just toss them over the figures, and it's not going to muss up your figures much, and then you can pull it away and not cause a lot of problems. So.
Okay, I'm sold on the pipe cleaner.
Yeah, the pipe cleaner is really great. I have one of my players bought a whole big multi-pack, and like I said, other than the fact that, you know, you'll immediately turn around and people have these very elaborate headsets. You know, they'll either have a big elaborate headset or they'll have like a spider that's climbing across it. And, you know, 38 pipe cleaners went into the spider and you can't get them undone. So, you know, other than the fact that people immediately have
other
to start screwing.
Fun.
Although I have the same problem with Dwarven Forge too, you know. The minute you build like your Dwarven Forge thing, everybody turns into a kindergartner again. And you turn and you look away and you turn back and then the whole thing's disassembled. And you're like, it took me an hour to put that together. They're like, what do you mean? You know, they're moving their blocks all over the place.
How much have you spent on Dwarven Forge?
Man, too much. You know, but not as you know, it's not like I'm not into cars and I'm not into golf and I'm not into anything else. So,
I've been to his house.
It's really impressive.
It's really impressive.
You know, Dwarven Forge is great, but it is they if you ever go to the Dwarven Forge forums and talk to the people that are into it, they call it the addiction, and they're absolutely right because it was actually Michelle that got me my first set, and I think I had 11 sets. You know, by the end of that year. So.
Yeah.
I love, and you know, I'll tell you the best site where, you know, I started seeing how they got used was Penny Arcade, and I forget who the guy was from Penny Arcade.
Gabe, that's amazing.
He got a couple of Dwarven Forge sets. I think now they give him free ones, but he clearly only had a couple of Dwarven Forge sets, and anybody who has it knows that you really can't do a whole lot with a couple of sets. But he started showing how you can mix it with dungeon tiles and how you can mix it with other maps. And now, yeah, I love to make these kind of, you know, where you'll use like a, you know, the Paizo. I keep getting corrected on the name of Paizo.
I keep saying Paizo.
I keep saying Piazzo, and I was like, what the hell are you talking about? I'll set up like a Paizo map and kind of draw some terrain and then set like ruins that are on it. And that way, you know, it's kind of a pseudo 3D effect. And it really, it can make for a lot of fun. But that's hard, you know, because you kind of want to build the same rooms over and over again. So trying to come up with new creative ways to make a room that's exciting can be difficult, but it's really a good time.
Where he had the mirrors and the laser.
Yeah, he was right. Yeah, I mean, he kind of shamed us all into getting more creative with our maps.
Yeah.
Like, he'd only been playing for like 6 months. We're like, come on, I've been playing for 25 years and I never came up with anything like that. So, you know, it's good and bad. Now we're all held to a much higher standard.
Yeah.
That's been my new favorite thing. Is I went to like a Michael's and I picked up these little tea lights.
Michael's
that they
is
have.
The greatest place to go for D&D.
Yeah, sure. You kind of lose your man card when you go in there to buy some of this stuff. But you get these little like wedding tea light things.
Yeah, I wear as manly of clothing as possible. I'll put on my combat.
Go in on your Harley.
That's why I grew the beard.
It's a fake.
The other thing for Michael's is if you do 3D war game modeling, you can take the phone.
Yeah, I need to go pick some of that up because I need some 3D like sand and stuff.
What the hell are all these other gamers?
Yeah. Right. I had to go in and say, like, hey, do you have any more of these little wedding tea lights that hang off the wine glasses? And like, yeah, I'm like, I need like 70 of them. Are you having a wedding? No, I got a game on Thursday and I need them. Yeah. So those kind of things are those are.
A friend of mine he had a Lego set of the astronauts, a little helmet. And he had an invisibility ring, and whenever he went invisible, he just put the little helmet on.
Right. There's a guy that you knew exactly. You guys know who this is, but there's a guy who, whenever he roleplays, his guy has an eye patch. So whenever he roleplays, he goes like this, and you immediately know, he's in roleplay mode. You know, so he'll say something.
We do the same.
I hate you. You're like, he's in roleplay.
Me and my buddies at home, I play a half orc. So whenever I'm playing my half orc, I have to do this. And whenever we're speaking in a language that no one else at the table knows, their characters don't know it, we go like this.
It's a good little trick for
And everyone knows, don't pay attention to what they're saying, because they're talking in a language we don't understand.
Who uses dungeon tiles? Who uses the Wizards dungeon tile stuff? Do you have any tricks that you use for keeping those things in place, or do you just lay them out? Yeah, I'll tell you, my favorite thing, the thing that made dungeon tiles something that I just really never used to something that I use almost all the time was using... sticky tack, the little blue sticky poster tack. And you can get like a little poster board. Yeah, I'm glad you brought it. You can get some poster board, and then, you know, while you're setting it up, instead of figuring out what the map's going to look like and then building it. You can build the whole thing on this board.
And it won't get knocked around.
And it won't get knocked around, and you're done. And you can literally file it vertically until you're ready, and then pull the thing out and then just drop it on the table. And what I like, and this is a...
if you're running at conventions, large conventions...
Yeah, a lot of people do that.
Gen Con and Origins, yeah. Especially with the RPGA.
Yeah, look at those artist portfolio.
This module 7 times. They put it on the poster board. Yeah. Some people just glue it there.
Especially the Dungeon
Delves. Yeah, right, for Delves. I think the Delves they use it. Yeah.
That's the only way they use Delves.
The other one I like is, you were talking about random encounters and using random encounters for things, is, and I got this idea from Dragon Age again. You know, I pull a lot from Dragon Age. They have random encounters in Dragon Age that continue to use the same general layout over and over again. So they have like a generic city layout, or a city street, or a generic wilderness. So you can actually build those on with dungeon tiles. And then store them away. And then if you have like a battle that occurs on the road, you just pull out your road set and put it on the thing. And it might be the same road set that they've seen before, but you flip it around and put them coming in from the other side. Or now it's on fire. Or you do some kind of craziness. That's
a lot of way like it. Poster maps. It's having a large bank of poster maps.
Yeah.
Choose from too.
Yeah, yeah. They had Wizards published all those two pack poster map packs, and I don't think you can get them anymore.
Yeah.
Those are great.
But they come with every adventure, at least.
Yeah, right, right. I think that there's some cases they're worth the cost of the adventure for that. Egg timers, I like egg timers.
Egg timers,
you guys
are good.
Use those at all?
No, hate them.
Really?
Yeah.
I have a couple that players that they will sit and pontificate their way through a battle for an hour if I don't do something to go.
Well,
look.
What I do is
and then they roll and miss anyway.
Like, if I get to a player's turn and if they have their action ready and they're ready to go, I'll give them like an untyped +1 bonus to their attack or something.
I'll use poker chips and write +1 on it and then throw it at them, and then they can throw it back in when they're
ready to use it. And that motivates them to be ready when it's their turn.
Right. Positive reinforcement.
Right.
Yeah. So you don't have any, you don't give any restriction on players'
turns? No, I mean, we'll say, you got to do something or we're going to move on, but it doesn't happen all that often.
Really?
Like, I want
you don't
people,
have like a war room of people that get together?
It means that they're interested,
the
it means they're actually
Normandy.
Thinking about it. Like even if it's, because like so much can change, especially at higher levels between your turn. Mm-hmm. Like there's, to an extent, a certain, like you can't really plan ahead for some things. So I I like to give people time to like reassess the situation, be able to do something interesting. Mm-hmm. If it gets crazy, I say stuff, and I think the initiative helps a lot with it, to make sure that doesn't happen. But right. I hate restricting people by time and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that I have players at my table where three of them will get together and they will plan a single move for, and they're not, like a lot of time it's they're bickering and arguing. They're
right.
not. They're not planning out a really
right,
solid tactic. Yelling
like,
at you, why aren't you using this power? We gotta,
My soldier would be like, "It's your turn.
Alone.
You guys shut up." Yeah.
Right. So I had another game where if you spoke about any kind of tactic, like something of the order of, "Hey, can you mark that guy?" It would be like you just lost your turn. So everybody's sitting quietly.
Yeah, I hate that.
that was too far in the other direction.
And as a DM, I try not to screw my players out of anything, if it's not tough to go back and fix, like I say, well, did you want to mark that guy, even though, like, they may have been a turn or two, and they're like, oh, yeah, I run with it, or if I say, if they forget, an extra couple points of damage, as long as it doesn't get excessive, I've had, my previous campaign, I had a guy who would just out and out cheat. And he would just start adding numbers to things, and I would just, cut him off.
That's impossible for you, because I've completely lost control over what characters are capable of.
Yeah, well, if they'll say, miss, but they're off by two, I'll be like, did you factor in combat advantage and that kind of thing?
Yeah.
But, if they start, but then I've got this bonus, maybe, and this bonus, it's just we'll move
tough.
On.
I try to influence the players, especially when they have these crazy attacks and stuff, to... 3x5 card, write out how their bonuses are working out. That way when they come to it, and like this poor guy, I was like, I'll do 184 points of damage. Even other tables were like, what?
Yeah.
So I showed him my little index card. Well, I didn't have to show him. He believed me. He knew what I was doing. But other people would have to look at it, and they'll be like, okay.
Oh, I guess
but
so.
Anyway, so, you want to influence your players at that if they're going to be pulling off these crazy combinations and stuff. Have them say, hey, man, why don't you have this ready so that if there's any question, you can just show and boom, we move on.
Yeah, I have an audit thy neighbor rule, where, the guy on your left has to, let's take a hard look at those, that attack score. Because
right.
We have a couple. We have a fighter who decided that his opportunity attack is going to be his primary attack. So it's 10 higher on attack rolls and, plus 37 damage or something on OAs. And I always can't get my head around how he got there, but he did. So, you know, I have a clear rules lawyer at the table, and he's right. my auditor. And I just can't keep track of what players' powers are. There's too many books coming out too fast. So I think we've gone over on time, so we'll go ahead and end it here.